Welcome back. I'm Elisa.
I'm Justine.
And we are the
Murder Sisters.
Okay. And we are back with episode number 33. I don't have anything to announce. You probably don't either.
Nope.
So let's just dive right in. So the episode that we are going to be covering today is a 62-year-old mystery. It's a complete mystery, and it's like no other case that we've covered to date. And I've been really, really excited and eager to record this. So I hope you guys like it as much as we have enjoyed researching it. The case that we're going to be covering today is called the Dyatlov Pass Incident. And the Dyatlov Pass Incident is an incident that left 9 very experienced Russian hikers dead after they went on a wilderness hike in the northern Ural Mountains between February 1st and February 2nd in 1959. The group of experienced Russian hikers had come together to plan a skiing expedition across the northern Urals in Sverdlovsk Oblast, Soviet Union.
Sounds right.
Bear with me. The names in this are really, really difficult. The goal of this trip was that they would all graduate from grade 2 hikers, like hiking, skiing certification to grade 3 level certification upon the return of the trip. The trip's leader was named Igor Dyatlov. He was 23 years old at the time that he put this trip together, and he was attending Ural Polytechnic Institute as a radio engineering student. And he put the group together that consisted of 8 men and 2 women, most of which were also students at the Ural Polytechnic Institute with him. As I mentioned, they were each individual in this group were very experienced in wilderness hiking and skiing. And all of them had their grade 2 certifications. And actually grade 3, which is what they were shooting for, was the highest level of certification that the Soviet Union offered at the time. So the process to receive that level of certification was definitely not easy. It required that each member keep their own journal, and they had to basically document their entire trip. They had to take pictures every day of their whole entire trip to like basically prove
show that they
did it.
Mm-hmm.
And the group was required to traverse 300 kilometers in quote unquote extreme conditions.
Wow.
So
they're like, find the extremest conditions and go traverse it.
Yeah. And then we'll certify you.
Maybe.
And take lots of pictures. So the 300 kilometer route was actually created by the Dyatlov group themselves. And the whole goal of their route that they came up with was to reach the far northern region of the Sverdlovsk Oblast.
Okay.
And the upper streams of the Luzva River.
That sounds Russian. Like
okay, wow.
Yeah, Luzva. I like it.
Thank you.
Sorry to the Russian audience members.
Now, they couldn't just plan their own route and go for it. The route had to actually be reviewed and approved by the Sverdlovsk City Route Commission. The commission actually approved the route that they
came up with. This sounds dangerous. Mm-hmm. Go do it.
So they got the approval they got approved for a group of 10 to travel on January 8th, 1959. So the group was to reach Otorten, which is a mountain that is 6.2 miles north of the site where the incident occurred. So they were only 6.2 miles away from reaching basically their end goal.
Wow. So close.
Yeah. But when you think about it, yeah, it's so close.
But like when you're trekking through the snow.
And it's really hardcore and yeah.
Yeah. Extreme.
Like it's not
extreme conditions.
Not like a neighborhood walk or like a little
and like
light
6
trail.
Miles. I do that like every.
That's nothing.
Like in a week.
They were to have completed that whole route by February. On January 23rd of 1959, the group was issued their route book, which outlined their entire course. And the route book listed, like I said, approval for 10 people. Keep in mind that I mentioned that there were 9 deaths. So
9.
There were 10 people total. 9 of them died.
Okay.
And on January 25th, the group had arrived by train to a town called Ivdel. From there, they took a truck ride to a small town called Vizhai.
Don't ask me.
Okay.
You're looking at me and I'm like.
Vizhai?
I'm going to just say letters when it comes to.
Okay. Which was said.
First letters.
Okay. Which was said to be the last inhabited settlement to the north. So it was a very small town. Once they were in the village of Vizhai, the group purchased loaves of bread and they basically like carbo loaded for a couple days before their trip.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. I'm like, that's right up my alley. So they ended up spending 2 nights in that little town and the group set out on their route towards Gora Tordon. After only 1 day of travel, one member of the group by the name of Yuri Yudin, he was suffering from severe like knee and joint pain because he had congenital heart defects and rheumatism.
Wow.
So.
And he went on this.
Keep in mind, he's certified. He's a level 2 certification.
Yeah.
He's very experienced.
Yeah.
But like I said, it had to be this extreme level of, mm-hmm. you know, weather mm-hmm. and all this. So I think like the extreme weather conditions kind of exacerbated his.
Yeah. Well, I would be like
issues.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's why there were 10 to begin with and 9 of them died.
Got
the 10th one.
Yeah. I'm trying not to say gotcha. So gotcha. I went,
got
you.
I got you. So Yuri Yudin was the one that survived out of the group.
Okay.
If you could,
but he like yeah. didn't really.
He didn't. Yeah. He only made it one day.
He was part of the group, but not real.
Yeah. So he ended up returning on his own. The rest of the group continued hiking for several more days. After several days of hiking, they had arrived at the edge of a highland area. At that highland area, they basically like stashed a cache of food and equipment that they would use for their return trip. So that they didn't have to carry it all, you know. So the following morning, the group set out on their route and everything, according to their journals, which some of them were recovered, aside from there was one member of the group who kept the most detailed journal and his was missing.
What?
So, you know, they do know that according to their journal notes.
How did they know his was the most detailed?
I think it was kind of like they knew enough because of that one guy that stayed back.
Oh, okay. It's like this guy. Like,
yeah,
really
he was able
good.
To give them some like.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know, some information. This one guy, I cannot pronounce his name, but he was the one that was keeping the most detailed notes.
Okay.
Everyone else was keeping notes and everything, but it wasn't up to that, like his detailed level. But according to their journals, the group had planned to go over the pass and make a camp for the night on the other side of the pass. Unfortunately, the weather conditions changed and they changed for the worse. And it was extreme snowstorms and it caused low visibility and they had gotten way off track and they had deviated west of their planned route. And by the time that they had like realized how far they had deviated off of their planned route, they had traveled a long time and they were just exhausted.
Is that part of the extreme weather conditions? Like to see if you can handle navigate correctly?
Well, and I don't think I think a lot of it has to do with the navigation, but a lot of it also has to do with like, what are you supposed to do when you come into contact with like,
extreme
conditions. Do you like find a place on your route to
camp out until
they tried to continue traveling and they got way off track.
Yikes.
And they were, you know, so
sounds like not good for their whole.
Yeah. So by the time they had kind of landed in whatever spot they were in, they decided to set up their camp on the side of a mountain instead of traveling a short distance of 0.93 miles downhill to
and like you said we
say short distance,
Elisa, short distance like a hop, skip and a jump, but downhill
it was 0.93 miles downhill, and the area was forested and it was, it provided much more shelter for them. And they would have been way more sheltered from the unforgiving weather.
9.93. Oh, 0.93. Yes. That is short.
Yeah.
That's actual short.
And Yuri, the one that stayed back, he actually speculated that the reason that they didn't seek the shelter in the forested area was possibly due to Dyatlov wanting to keep the altitude that they had gained and to also gain experience camping on the side of a mountain.
Oh, whoa. Let's so, take this as an opportunity.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, mm-hmm. I've never like backpacked or like went hardcore to the snow like mountain. Yeah. But I'm sure the elevation thing, the altitude thing.
Yeah.
That makes sense, kind mm-hmm, of. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how much altitude you would lose just going down a little.
I don't know either. Miles. And I don't want to like speculate on that. But, yeah, I'm sure it's an issue. So,
yeah. And ultimately, the choice to stay on the side of the mountain would end up costing them their lives.
Wrong choice.
Yeah.
And then that whole incident is like named after this guy who like made the decision, yeah, which is like, way to go down in history, bro.
Yeah.
But anyway. Yes.
So apparently Dyatlov was planning on sending a telegram to their sports club once they returned back to that little town, Vizhai. And he expected that they would be returning from their trip sometime around February 12th. But Dyatlov actually had told Yuri, you know, I think this trip is going to take a lot longer than we had anticipated. Mm-hmm. So don't be expecting us to get back, like get a letter back on February 12th, like yeah. we had thought we would be. Mm-hmm. So Yuri was not alarmed when February 12th had come and gone and he hadn't heard from the rest of his group members. And it wasn't until February 20th when the family members of the group contacted the Institute and demanded that they send out searchers to look for their family that they realized like, hey, I think these guys are in trouble.
Yeah. Okay.
So
that's what I was thinking or wondering is like, is it, they're like, okay, good luck on your trip. Bye.
Yeah.
Hope to see you.
Yeah. So.
So they're like monitoring it. Mm-hmm. And thankfully the guy came back. So you can kind of give them some info.
All right. Yeah. And so they know based on the journals and all of that, that they landed on that side of the mountain on February 1st through the 2nd. And mm-hmm. people weren't starting to look for them until February 20th.
Oh, so that was kind mm-hmm. of a long.
And the initial search was done by volunteers consisting mostly of the students and teachers from the Polytechnic University that they attended. Mm-hmm. And then later, Army and police got involved with the search and they used planes, helicopters. They really
did everything.
Yeah. This was like a all hands on deck search. Mm-hmm. And again, the area and all of that stuff, it was difficult. So these people that were searching for them had to
were
have
risking
experience.
Their, yeah. And we're also like mm-hmm. risking their safety and stuff.
Uh-huh. So at this point, I will pass it off to Justine to get into the next kind of details of the case.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Okay.
Okay.
That was a joke.
Good job, Jess.
So on February 26th of 1959, searchers had located the group's tent on Kolat Sayah. I don't know.
You okay. don't have to. Just at the side of a hill.
On the side of the hill that they were on. The tent had been abandoned and was very damaged. Mikhail Sheravan. This is, I'm going to pronounce it like the way
That's
I
fine.
Need to.
That's fine. Mikhail. Mikhail.
Elisa. The student that located the tent said, quote, the tent was half torn down and covered with snow. It was empty and all the group's belongings and shoes had been left behind. Investigators had reported that the tent had actually been cut open from the inside and that 9 sets of footprints in both socks and barefoot could clearly be seen leading down a path to a nearby wooded area that was approximately, like Elisa stated, 0.93 miles to the northeast from their camp. So that was, mm-hmm. yeah. Okay.
Yep.
So many questions already right?
Mm-hmm.
After following the tracks for 1,600 feet, the tracks were covered up with snow and could no longer be followed. The searches continued in the hopes of finding some sort of sign that the group had been there or were possibly still in the area. Dead or alive, I guess, you know?
Well, I mean, I think they're assuming it's dead.
Yeah.
It's a recovery. They're
like, how did you live here?
Yeah, recovery, oh, yeah. Not a rescue.
Body recovery. Wow, Lisa, you do know environmental outdoor stuff.
That's just murder.
That's just murder, girl. They found the remains of a small fire at the forest's edge, along with the bodies of Yuri Krivonoshenko,
who was 23. Oh, that was good.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, it was.
And Yuri. Oh, another Yuri.
Yeah, there's a lot of Yuris.
Doroshenko, 21. Doroshenko.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't say that was good that time.
Oh, okay.
So here's where we go. Kriv and Dor were, that's those people I just said. Mm-hmm. Kriv and Dor were shoeless and dressed only in their underwear. The tree that they were located under had broken branches that reached up to 5 meters high, suggesting that one or both of them had attempted to climb up the tree to get some sort of like vantage point or to or like, see or get away from something.
Yeah.
Or why else do you climb up a tree, right?
I don't.
Between the pine tree that the first two bodies were found underneath and the camp, there were three more bodies found. The three bodies belonged to Dyatlov, Zenaida Kolmogorova, 22, and Rustem Slobodin, 23.
Mm-hmm. So that was, Dyatlov was the group leader.
Yes, we know that.
Uh-huh. The second one that you said,
Zenaida?
Yeah, that's one of the girls.
Okay.
And then just one of the dudes.
Yeah. He said, then who cares? Ali.
Sorry.
Their bodies were found in such a way that would suggest that they were making their way back up to their tent. I don't know what that would look like.
Okay. And so here's, I did a lot of Googling and I actually found some maps that could kind of
show you what
show
it means.
You where the bodies were.
And maybe, okay.
Because I have to, I'm very visual. So
that's how I am. I'm like, I need to see what this,
I pictured,
or like picture it in my head.
A lot of it in my head, and it's pretty close. I mean, the way that it's explained and described is pretty close to what
I know
it
what
was.
I see yeah. What's going on here.
And these bodies were not found clumped together, this group in particular.
It's like they were all going
They were
towards...
going up in a, almost like in a line.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Their bodies were, said that already. And their bodies were found 980, 1570, and 2070 feet from the tree.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that, yeah, they weren't, right, like I said, not next to each other. They were in basically a line.
According to authorities, all five of the hikers had perished from hypothermia, and their bodies showed no indication of external damage beyond what had been inflicted by the weather conditions, the cold weather conditions. But the autopsy did show that Doroshenko was, quote, brown purple, end quote, in complexion. And he had gray foam coming from his right cheek and gray liquid coming from his mouth. Also, the hands of the two hikers under the cedar tree, Yuri and Yuri, were like scraped away. And so it looked like the, you know, and the, and as I mentioned earlier, the branches of the tree above them were torn down. So it's like the two men were like trying desperately, actually, not like they could have possibly been climbing the, it's like, okay, we see these broken limbs, the tree limbs. And then we also see, like the, and then we inspect the bodies and see that their hands are like scraped off.
And you can actually, like, if your stomach can handle it, if you do some Googling on
Googan, as you called it,
Googan, I was able to see picture, like kind of autopsy pictures and pictures that were taken of them when their bodies were found in the snow. So you can also kind of get an idea of what
it's
kind
like
of condition they're in.
The descriptions of these conditions are so like bizarre and extreme that you almost don't believe it. And so it's almost, it's like,
it's crazy.
It's like, I have to see that this actually was real, like what they actually saw. Anyway. And so, you know, if that isn't strange enough, Slobodin had endured head injuries that were consistent with someone falling and hitting their head over and over again. Mm-hmm. So it's like falling from a tree and hitting, but he
multiple blunt force trauma injuries.
While Kolmogorova had a baton-shaped bruise on her side. So that to me is like tree branches or something.
Yeah, something.
I don't know.
Yeah.
All of these injuries would suggest that there was like more at play in terms of the cause of death for the five members.
Yeah, because keep in mind they said hypothermia.
It's like...
That's not hydrothermia.
It's, well, unless they were like desperately trying to get away and then...
Get away from what?
We'll get into that later. Locating the remaining four members of the group took a whopping 2+ months, which, I mean, good on them for continuing to look.
Yeah.
The remaining members, Nikolai, 23, Ludmila, 20, and Semyon, 38, and Alexander, 24. I'm not saying their last names, but we will list them.
It's fine.
We're located on May 4th, 1959, in a ravine under 13 feet of snow and 246 feet further into the woods from the pine where the two Yuris were found. Three of the four members that were found were dressed. Okay, this is another weird. Were dressed in what appeared to be the clothing of the other members of the group. So, for example, Dubanina was wearing Kriv's pants that were burned and torn up, and her left foot and lower leg were wrapped in someone else's torn jacket. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to get into the like really strange details regarding the conditions of the bodies that were found. I mean, if it's not weird,
the last four bodies that were found made the whole thing
like it's because these first you're like, oh, okay, they tried to climb up a tree, they fell, they hit their head 100 times on a branch, this other person hit their side, they try to climb up the tree, they're scraped, wearing other people's clothes,
you can kind of like
piece that
convince
story
yourself that it's just, oh, it was this little thing and that.
Here we go. All right, so the other ones that shifted, like Elisa said, shifted the entire narrative of the case and added the extra layer of mystery to theories surrounding like what could have possibly happened to this group of nine experienced hikers and skiers. One of them had major skull damage. Dubanina, you've heard me say her name a couple of times, had major chest fractures in addition to missing her entire tongue, eyeballs, part of her lips, facial tissue, and a fragment of skull. My first thought is frostbite. Like it would start, I don't know though.
But where do they get your eyeballs don't just... and tongue don't just disappear.
I don't know.
They don't just like
frostbite, obviously.
Obviously. It would freeze those things. It wouldn't like disintegrate them. It's like they froze and then shattered.
Do you have a freezer in your home?
Yeah. God.
My food disappeared.
Oh my God.
Anyway. Anyway, okay. Zolotaryov.
You could just say Zolo.
Thank you. Zolo also had major chest fractures and both of his eyes were missing as well. And Kolevatov was missing his lips, although he did not suffer the same extreme injuries as the other three members that were found in May. As I mentioned previously, the members found in May had been wearing the clothing of the other members found back in February.
Yeah.
So it's not even like these two groups were like together and then they're like, you got injured, here's my clothes. It's like, you know,
yeah, it's really weird
swapping. So that suggests that the group found in May had died after the members found in February.
So the group, the last group that was found had the clothing of, so remember the two guys that were found first, Yuri. They were Yuri's. Like basically naked.
Yeah.
And then the group that was found in May had some of their clothing items on them.
Oh, so you're saying, oh, it's not a me being friendly and giving you the shirt off my back.
No, it's like those dudes died and I'm going to survive, so I'm taking
their clothes. Oh, Elisa.
Because remember, and a lot of them didn't have shoes on. That's why that girl had a jacket wrapped around her feet.
Yeah.
So it's survival.
Oh.
But it's like how... It's just a weird...
Oh my gosh.
Like how did that come to be?
It kind of reminds me of like Lord of the Flies or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Except for I don't think that they killed each other.
Well, I don't know. Anyway. I've said anyway way too many times tonight.
Anyway.
Anyway. Enough of that. All right. Where was I? We just went off on a crazy thing. Which is
suggests that that group died after the group.
As I also mentioned earlier, Dubonina had been found with Kriv's pants wrapped around her foot and leg. But what's stranger is the fact that Zolo was found wearing Dubonina's faux fur coat and hat, which probably meant that Zolo had taken Dubonina's coat and hat after she had passed away. Just like kind of like, you know, recapping what Elisa said about how that could have played out.
Yeah, because like, the they were all basically wearing each other's clothes.
Yeah, nuts. And another strange layer to this case is the fact that the clothing found on Cole and Dubonina had... I love that name. I'm like, yeah, Dubonina. And I'm probably like butchering that.
That's good.
Dubonina, that's my friend. She's my friend. Dubonina had tested positive for radioactive material. Despite the strange nature of this case and the totally unexplainable causes of death for the 9 members of this group, the Soviet government gave only vague causes of death and suggested that the group's own incompetence had led to their deaths. But keep in mind, I'm going to say it once. Elisa said it 100 times. We're going to say it again. Very experienced hikers and skiers and were on this voyage to obtain their grade 3 certification, which is the highest certification that was offered by the Soviet Union at the time. So I'm personally not buying this explanation of incompetence, and I think it's bull honky.
Yeah,
that they would tarnish their names and like...
Well, it's just a way to shove something under the rug.
Yeah.
Brush it under the... I'm gonna shove it in the closet.
Stay in that closet. There have been many odd theories in regards to what happened to the Dyatlov group, some of which I will go into. There's so many. We're just going to cover some. There's way too many. But these are the most popular. And some of the other theories that weren't as popular but were like out there.
Mentioned. Yeah.
Are a UFO alien encounter.
I love that one.
I obviously. Everything's an alien encounter. If you can't explain it.
Yeah.
It's you unexplained. Alien it. Yeah. Yeah. And radiation exposure. But what? Okay, sure. But how?
Yeah, radiation exposure. Okay.
Yeah, so, I'm buying it.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm
done.
Well,
I'm going to debunk that really quickly since you brought it up.
Okay.
So the clothing items that were found belonged to 2 people that actually worked for a radioactive cleanup prior to coming onto the Dyatlov group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why
following.
So that's why they had radioactive material on their clothing.
Oh.
It was basically they were exposed to it from like a cleanup that they did.
Whoa. So they were just exposed to it.
Yeah, big time. It was like a big issue.
Oh, okay. So it's not like nowadays where hopefully you don't get exposed.
No, it was like residual from their clothing.
Wow.
So that's why that one wasn't as like...
Radioactivity is crazy.
So that's why that theory wasn't...
Okay.
It didn't hold too much weight.
All right. I won't get excited about it. Out. That's out. So here's a first theory is that Manzi tribesmen were responsible for attacking and killing the Dyatlov group. The theory suggests that a sudden attack would account for the way in which the hikers had fled their tents, the disarray that they had left the tent in, and the damage done to the second group of bodies. But that explanation fizzled quickly due in large part to the fact that the Manzi people were a very peaceful group, so don't get it twisted. And the evidence in the Dyatlov past did not suggest that the group had come into contact with another group of humans and that there had been any kind of like violent altercation. Also, it is thought that the injuries sustained by the group members could not have been inflicted by other humans. If you look at the damage inflicted on the hikers' bodies, it's clear that the injuries exceeded the force of trauma that one human could inflict on another. And to add to that, there were no other footprints found anywhere around mm-hmm. the site that the group were found aside from their own. So that theory was quickly debunked. The second theory, the group had been killed by an extreme avalanche. An extreme avalanche.
Not just a normal avalanche.
Would explain why the group had thrashed through the tent. And that's what I was kind of thinking.
Like they were just so frantic. Left they couldn't in a hurry. Mess with the zipper.
Yeah, without their shoes and socks. This would also, yeah, the crushing and blunt force injuries that were inflicted on them. Trees coming down with the avalanche.
But
this theory doesn't hold much water, though, because for one, there was no evidence of an avalanche and there was no report of any avalanches occurring in the area. And they would probably also be able to see
there were no evidence. Down trees. And another weird thing is they had all had their skis in the snow and none of the skis were knocked over.
Oh, my gosh. This is nuts.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I taught her that.
Third thing. The group had killed each other due to some sort of love triangle or going crazy.
Yeah.
There had been dating among the group, so it was theorized that a love triangle among the group had led to some large feud that resulted in the group murdering each other, like
I'm not buying
as
that.
You do in the snow. It's, you know what? I'm over this. Let's yeah. just all
I don't know.
Kill
the vibe
other.
That I got was they were all, it was pretty much like a family. Like they were tight. Yeah. I don't think they would just be. Like,
and it's they're survivalists or whatever it's called. So they aren't going to let some emotional stuff like get in the way.
Yeah. That's part of
how they are.
Yeah. Oh, good point.
This obviously not a theory that would explain away the injuries that are not due to a human. They were more compared to a car accident. And so also it doesn't explain anything and the clues and the everything. Fourth theory is that the Menk, which is a kind of Russian Yeti.
Hell yeah.
Hell
get
Yeti.
Get ready for the Yeti.
Elisa.
I thought
that
that's
a
what
meme.
You were going to say.
No.
Get
I was
ready
gonna
for
say,
the Yeti.
Hell Yeti. That was not good and yours was great.
Thank you.
Get ready for the Yeti. We are funny. Okay. Is responsible for the deaths of the group. According to those that believe in this theory, it would account for the immense force and the power necessary to cause the injuries to the three. I mean, like, I'm trying to take it seriously, but
yeah, it's like,
This theory is popular among people that have focused on the damage to Dubonina's face, like her missing tongue, lips, and eyes. But what is the eyes? Like, why? What would a Yeti need with eyes? Like,
maybe
that
they have
takes
a lot of
precision.
Protein and stuff.
It takes precision to, like, take the. It's like,
and
if
I
you
think
have big
it-
Yeti hands, you're not going to be like.
And I think it was almost, it looked like they were just plucked out of there.
Oh my.
And a whole entire tongue was gone. Not just the tip of the tongue, not just half the tongue, the whole entire tongue.
Oh, Elisa.
Sorry.
I haven't had dinner yet. Yeah, we don't buy it. This fourth theory.
Yeah, it's like.
Final theory.
I mean, that's fun, but it's.
Yeah. Leave Yetis in Disneyland.
Yeah.
Isn't that where they're?
Matterhorn?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fifth and final theory that has gained popularity during the 60 plus years of this case being unsolved is that the deaths are the result of some like government or military weapons activities. Okay. So this theory held more weight because another group had been hiking only 31 miles away from the Diet Love group and had seen orange orbs that they said appeared to be floating in the sky in the area of Kolotsayaki.
Good job, Jess.
Is it Sayaki or Sayaklov?
Yeah,
Sayako. Which could be Sayaki. That sounds more Japanese.
Yeah.
Anyway. Oh, there Saki. I am with that. Anytime. Every time I say anyway, pinch my thigh.
No.
Which could be interpreted as being explosions from military weapons. So, okay. All right. It's not UFOs. It's, yeah, military stuff. According to this theory, it is believed that the sound of the weapons led to the group fleeing their tents in a panic, and that the first group, which were half clothed, died of hypothermia while attempting to take shelter from the weapon blasts by waiting by the tree lines. Then the second group had seen the first group freeze to death, and they were like determined to go back to the tent to collect their belongings, but they too fell victim to hypothermia. Well, the third group got caught in like a fresh blast fresh blast further into the forest.
Because the last group had all the crushed.
Oh, yeah.
And the missing eyeballs and the missing tongues and the crushed chest.
Oh, no. And then died from their injuries. I don't know about the hitting head over and over again. And yeah. I don't even know about the missing eyes, tongues, and lips either. Missing eyes?
It just doesn't explain it.
And yeah, it's so selective, like the eyes.
And it's like, we could say, I've never heard of an animal taking an entire tongue.
Or just a tongue, just the eyes.
Yeah. It's like they would pluck it. I feel
I want to do like even more research on like what animals like eyeballs. I don't know.
Let's say vulture.
Oh.
But they were like buried under 14 feet, 13 feet of snow.
Good. Lev Ivanov, who was the chief investigator of the Dyatlov Pass incident, had stated, quote, "I suspected at the time and am almost sure now that these bright flying spheres had a direct connection to the group's death," end quote. When he was interviewed by a small newspaper in 1990, since then, censorship and secrecy in the USSR has forced him to retract his line of questioning into this theory. At the end of this case, the hikers' deaths were officially ruled as being caused by, quote, "a compelling natural force," end quote, and the case was closed. In 2019, Russian officials reopened the case. However, this time, the only theories that would be considered included an avalanche, a snow slab, or a hurricane. And the case was once again closed with only a vague conclusion that no criminal activity caused the suspicious and bizarre deaths of the hikers. Again, investigators said in July 2020 that the hikers died of hypothermia after a slab avalanche pushed them out of their tent and into the cold. I don't know how an avalanche.
I think a slab avalanche. I'll tell you about it. Oh, okay.
So according to the National Geographic website, a slab avalanche. A slab avalanche is an avalanche that occurs when the weak layer lies lower down in a snowpack. So this layer is covered with other layers of compressed snow. So it's like loose snow and then tons of compressed snow at the top. Mm. When the avalanche is triggered, the weak layer breaks off, pulling all the layers on the top of it down the slope. So like just this big, you've seen videos of it before, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
National Geographic type videos where it's like,
oh, avalanches little, scare me.
This little like powdery snow that kind of gives way. And then it's big. It's not a rolling thing. It's like a slab.
Yeah.
It's like a slab of big compacted snow. These layers tumble, they fall in a giant block or slab. So despite this new information coming to light, I feel like this case is still like totally unofficially unsolved. It's the same avalanche theory. It's like,
well, and then remember the snow skis were still standing upright.
Yeah, Elisa.
And none of the trees were,
yeah, it's there's no evidence. Let's just say there was no evidence of any slab avalanche or any kind of avalanche. I don't know. I'm not buying it. The lips, the eyes, the tongue.
Yeah.
Let's go back to that. And the bruising. No, it's just so weird. So the mountainside where the group had passed away was later named the Dyatlov Pass in honor of the lost expeditioners. There was also a monument to remember the 9 hikers that was erected in the Mikhailov Cemetery. And really, they are the only ones that will ever know what truly happened to them between the days of February 1st and February 2nd in 1959. So that concludes our case. Awesome case, Elisa. Give you the creds, girl.
I do also want to, because after we kind of did the script, I've done the most Googling and research on this case than I've done on any of the other ones.
It fascinates me.
So I did look to see if there were any documentaries made on this, and I actually found one that came out this year.
No!
And it's called An Unknown Compelling Force.
I think I know what we're doing tonight, girl.
It costs, so I found it on Amazon Prime, and it's, if you do it in like SD, So not HD.
Oh, yeah. I always
it's
do it
$3.99.
Perfect. So I can afford that.
That's affordable.
With my new job.
Yeah. So if you guys are interested, we found some really good pictures. And I actually found a website that posted all of the pictures from all of the cameras that were recovered from.
Oh, all the cameras of the.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really so cool.
That was another like.
Yeah. Going down the rabbit hole.
That I fell into. And it's so sad because it's like all these wonderful pictures of them just having the time of their life.
Yeah, you sent me some of them and I'm like, oh my gosh, I could see these people in nowadays times.
Yeah.
Like they look and they're just like a good group of young people.
Having the best time ever.
And so living life.
We are going to post, I think like 3 or 4 pictures that we really liked, I guess.
On our Insta.
On our Insta.
On the gram.
Which is Murder Sisters Pod.
Yep.
Right.
Just like our email.
At Murder Sisters Pod. So check those out if you guys are interested in it. It's nice to see, kind of see the faces of everybody. And then we're going to try to find that map. Okay. I think that about does it.
That was a great case. Thank you, Elisa.
That was so fun.
Elisa, you get
thank
the.
Thank you. Thanks, y'all.
That's me clapping.
I hope you guys liked it as much as we did.
It was it's awesome.
One like, of those mysteries, and honestly, I have absolutely it. No idea what
we
happened.
Have. Usually, we're like, well, I think I'm Elisa debunked a bunch, but like, I don't have a theory of what happened.
I don't know what happened.
Well, and we may never know.
And it could be like the missing eyeballs and tongues could be a red herring. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, is that can't.
I don't know.
You know.
Anyway,
whatever.
Thanks for listening. Whatever. Subscribe to us because you never know when we're going to drop an
app. We're going to surprise y'all and post an episode.
Thanks. And
thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.